This is The Guardian.
I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story. On the 15th of January, an underwater volcano in the Western Pacific Ocean erupted, emitting a sonic boom that was heard in multiple countries.
Hunga Ha'apai volcano exploded.
A blast so massive it was seen from space. Satellite imagery caught the explosion and a ball of ash billowing above and beyond the Tongan Island.
Tsunami advisory in effect.
Its stunning power felt across five continents.
Tsunami waves crashed into the Tongan coastline. Warnings were issued for multiple countries, including the east coast of Australia, New Zealand, Japan.
It's probably one of the largest, most explosive events around the Ring of Fire for a long time.
On the nearby island nation of Tonga, all communication was lost. And for days, information about the impact on the ground was limited. Until now.
Hi. I can't quite believe I've got through to someone in Tonga after a full week of trying and failing.
Today, on the ground in Tonga. It's Tuesday, the 25th of January. Kate, what has this time been like covering this disaster? It's kind of a global story, but based out of our area in the Pacific.
Yes, it's been a very busy week, but also a very weird story to cover because it's a Tongan story. It's a Tongan volcano. The majority of the damage has been done to Tonga. And for days and days and days, we couldn't get any news from Tonga.
Kate Lyons is Pacific editor at Guardian Australia.
That's because when the volcano erupted, it did damage to the undersea communications cable that links Tonga with basically all communications. It's Tonga's internet, it's most of Tonga's phone service, and it broke that cable in two places. And so the rest of the world, it's like Tonga disappeared. And weirdly, we sort of knew what was happening, what the impacts of the volcano were from countries all over the world before we knew what the impacts were in Tonga. Mm. So the first deaths we heard of reported as a result of the volcanic eruption and then the tsunami, they were in Peru when two people died. They drowned because of abnormally large waves as a result of the tsunami. I mean, Lord Howe Island on the east coast of Australia was ordered to evacuate. People had to evacuate from their hotels and go to higher ground. We had tsunami warnings across the Pacific, Samoa, Fiji, Vanuatu, large waves in New Zealand. But the closest country to the volcano is Tonga, which is just 65 kilometres from the volcano to the country's capital of Nuku'alofa. So we're getting all this news from thousands of kilometres from the volcano, but the country to whom the volcano belongs, we knew nothing about what was going on there.
So what did you do? How did you go about getting in contact with people?
So I have been trying to get in contact with Tonga all week, as have many people, including really concerned family members in the Tongan diaspora all over the world. People reporting that even when they could get through to family members, they'd lucky if the call lasted, you know, more than 20 seconds before dropping out. So it's been difficult. I finally managed to get hold of someone. I got hold of Marion Kupu, who is a Tongan journalist for Broadcom Broadcasting in Tonga. She's in the capital of Nuku'alofa. Her radio station has a satellite. And so they were able to get in contact with the rest of the outside world before a lot of Tonga has been able to, because they've got this satellite connection.
Well, look, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me. I imagine this has been one of the busier weeks of your life.
For me, yes.
Tell me about her experience of this disaster. What happened?
Well, she first realized that something was off in Tonga last year. So people have known that the volcano was active in an active phase since all summer.
We were very well aware that there was a volcano, live volcano, since last year, because we've been hearing little explosions, clouds, lightning in during the night sometimes, you know.
And then on Thursday, so 2 days before the volcano erupted, things started to get worse.
In the morning, there was this very distinctive smell that we woke up to, and we thought it was from our septics, but it wasn't. A very, very distinctive smell. It was not a good smell all over Tonga.
And then on Friday, there was a small eruption from the volcano. There was a tsunami warning issued that was then retracted. And then she went down to the harbour and she saw that in Nuku'alofa Harbour, this, imagine, you know, like Sydney Harbour or wherever you are, a flat body of water. There were just these weird whirlpools and eddies just spinning in the centre of the harbour.
The water came up, they came swirling up, and then they swirled in, swirled out. Swirl came, they swirl in and swirl out just like that. It was like every 5 minutes. And they came with ashes. It wasn't clean water. It was dirty water. It was like ash water. That's when they issued a tsunami warning and then they cancelled it.
Mm. And then on Saturday, the 15th of January, about 5:10 p.m., the Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai undersea volcano erupted. There were four explosions, and NASA scientists have calculated that the blast of the eruption was 600 times more powerful than the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. So a huge blast. It sent ash and gas 20 kilometres into the air. The view of from the satellite images is just jaw-dropping, seeing this enormous grey mushroom cloud just explode over the ocean.
I was at home with my family, just the usual Saturday evening. The first explosion happened. It was Big Bang happened. We knew straight away that that's the volcano. Our ears were ringing. We couldn't hear each other. We can just mimic everyone just to run, just to go. Let's go. Let's go. And let's just leave the house. Let's evacuate. And you know that, you know, do you experience your ears when you're like flying in the airplane and then you, yes, it was like 10 times of that. We didn't know what to do. All we knew was to move away from Nuku'alofa, move away from the shoreline and go inland to Tonga.
Marion and her family just got in their car and drove. They knew they had to drive east, inland and away from the direction of the volcano, which is northwest of the capital where they live. And she said the main road of Nuku'alofa, normally it's two lanes of traffic, one in each, traveling in each direction. But on this day, it was four lanes of traffic or everyone heading east. Everyone was just fleeing the city.
So we were also using the side of the road, just going one direction. It was crazy.
And traffic came to a standstill, not just because there were so many cars on the road, but because the windshields of those cars were coated in such thick layers of ash that no one could see out of them.
We thought it was rain, but it was little bits of rocks. We thought it was rain because we can hear it clinging on top of the windshield, but then we didn't see any water. And we were like looking around, looking, we're like, where's the rain? Where's the rain? But there was no rain. It was those little rocks.
I mean, this ash coated absolutely everything we saw in satellite photos from afterwards and in aerial shots. We're talking about, I mean, Marion said that the whole sky went dark like it was nightfall 2 hours before nightfall normally comes. So by 6 p.m., and that's because there was an enormous blanket of ash that had coated the entire country, blocking the sun.
Everything was black. It was so dark.
And so in order to keep traffic moving, boys were running alongside the main road with water bottles, squirting water onto people's windshields so that they could wipe some of the ash away and keep driving.
Any vehicles they can come across just to wipe them, just to bring it down so that we can just start moving.
Marion and her family eventually made it to her brother's house. He lives in a designated sort of tsunami gathering point because he's on slightly higher ground and he's inland. And they were safe there and they stayed overnight and then were able to return to their home the next day.
We just didn't know what's next, right? Because we have never experienced this. But then the next day, which was a Sunday, there was still black dust coming down.
Normally on a Sunday, it's a very, very quiet day in Tonga. It's a day of religious observance, so nothing's open, nobody does anything, you're not meant to do your shopping. But because no one had been able to gather groceries on Saturday night for the day ahead, they were permitted. Actually, the Prime Minister made a national announcement on the radio to say you were permitted to go and get groceries today on Sunday.
So we can go out and go do our grocery shopping and also water and whatever we can do, because, you know, the electricity was down and all the things that we need to live through until Monday.
But then we're also told in that radio broadcast that apart from that, they should just stay home.
Stay indoors, close all doors and not to breathe the dust.
Miraculously, everyone Mary knew and her immediate family, they were okay.
First thing I did was to talk to my family. We're okay. Mom's okay. Everyone's okay at home. You know, my brothers is okay. Family, everyone's fine. That's all that matters now.
And so once the kind of the immediate drama and danger of the event was done, Marion, her journalist sense kicked in and she got to work.
And then I sent one of my niece pictures and I said, post that up and just credit me.
Marion started sending photos and videos of the aftermath of the disaster to her niece in Australia for her niece to post online and share with the outside world.
Apparently, I think that was the first in-country picture maybe that came out.
Yeah, yes. I saw your pictures. We were seeing them come through.
And they painted a pretty scary picture. Everything, absolutely everything was coated in ash. There were houses down. There were wrecks of cars wrapped around trees, boats that had been washed on shore, total destruction of some areas. While they were terrible, there was also, a large amount of relief at finally seeing something and of getting news from a Tongan in Tonga, so that, you know, a voice from this sort of abyss of communication. The world had been waiting for news from Tonga for days by this point and had heard nothing. We didn't even have confirmation of a death toll.
I was shocked when I had phone calls from the Netherlands, America, Berlin. I mean, you name it, I had calls from there.
But when we did have these photographs and this news from Marion and this sort of update that she was there and she was seeing the damage and assessing it and reporting as a great reporter, everybody flocked to Marion.
People started calling me and I answered their phone and they were like screaming. These strangers, they were screaming and they were like, do you know you're the first person to talk to us here in America from Tonga? And I'll be like, no. And I said, well, we're glad you're okay. How is it? They were like, oh, bombarded with all the questions, like, we're okay. We're okay, we're fine. And I didn't know that the whole world thought that Tonga disappeared from the face of the earth.
But while the world's worst fears weren't realised, Marion doesn't live in the worst affected area in Tonga. She doesn't even live in the worst affected area on the main island of Tonga. She's in the capital, but the picture elsewhere in Tonga, especially in the outer islands that were much closer to the volcano, are far, far worse.
Next, the damage and the road ahead for Tonga. So, Kate, what is the damage on the ground across Tonga?
Well, so firstly, it's helpful to know a little bit about Tonga's geography. It's an archipelago of more than 100 islands, 36 inhabited islands. Most people live on the main island, and the main island is 65 kilometres southeast of the volcano. So the volcano is to the west of the main island, which is why everyone was fleeing to the east There are a few small islands that are north of the mainland, but are quite close to the volcano. So Mango Island and Namuka Island, they were closer to the volcano than the main island, and they were hit badly. So in terms of lives lost, we've had three reported deaths in Tonga. The first one was a British national, and we heard about her death first because we had contact with her family in Britain and in Australia who were able to give us that news early on. And then later we learned and the government confirmed that a 65-year-old woman from Mango Island and a 49-year-old man from Namuka Island had also died. Several people have been injured, including one person on another small island, Ha'apai, who required emergency medical treatment. But overall, the death toll and even the injury count is far, far lower than I think all of us feared when we knew what an enormous eruption and huge tsunami had hit this country. And since the disaster, the government has released a statement saying that 84% in Tonga have been affected by the volcano eruption and ashfall and the tsunami damage. An enormous percentage of the country that have had structural damage, homes destroyed, damage to their livelihoods as a result of this disaster. In some areas, like on Mango Island, every single home was destroyed. Every structure on that island was flattened. And those 62 people from Mango Island have had to be evacuated to nearby Namuka because they've got nowhere to sleep. And even then, the government was saying they'll probably have to be evacuated from Namuka to the main island because of food and water shortages on Namuka Island, which was also hard hit by the volcano. So, I mean, that's a lot of trauma on top of trauma for these people.
What types of things has Marion seen on the ground of this damage?
Marion hasn't yet been able to make it out to the outer islands because obviously travel is very affected by what's gone on. But she has been able to travel to the worst hit part of the main island of Tongatapu, and that's the west coast. So she headed out there on Tuesday, just 3 days after the tsunami hit. It's about a 40-minute drive from the capital. And she said what she saw and what she smelt absolutely shocked her.
The smell of, I think, the seabed from way out there coming out, being washed on with mud and everything else. There were even dead fishes that were found there in like on land.
She also described the visible power of the tsunami days later on the landscape. So the tsunami waves had come from the west, and she said that everything on the western side of the main road she was driving down had literally been uprooted or picked up, carried across the road and smashed into the trees on the eastern side. So she's talking about roofs and buildings and cars and trees and bushes, just everything had been cleared from the west and dumped onto the eastern side.
Wow. So you're driving along the road and you look to the right, it's bare. You look to the left, it's just an enormous garbage pile of nature and houses and road. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly. She also said that the coconut trees were the ones that hadn't been ripped out of the ground, had all been bent almost parallel to the ground in the direction that the waves had hit them. So you can just imagine this really bizarre and scary image of just a wave of coconut trees in a row lying almost flat on the ground.
Everything is just dead. You can see mud. There's just dust, everything. Majority of the houses over there is just gone. Some houses are still standing, but everything inside is destroyed because from the seawater, beds, chairs, couches, everything gone. I mean, wet or destroyed. So it's not livable. Today, they start putting out tents. I saw tents around over there. But the problem is over there, first, they don't have electricity. Second, they don't even have running water. There's no water there. So they've been using big drums of water to use, you know, on a daily basis. And there's no clothes, there's no food because they have plantation there and all the plantation is gone. It's just like nothing.
So obviously for people living here whose homes have been destroyed here, life has been really, really tough this last week.
It's been nearly a week and a half. It sounds like incredibly tough conditions for people to live in for all of that time. What's going on the ground in terms of support and in terms of rebuilding?
Yeah, I mean, it's already started. It sort of started from the Monday. People were at work cleaning up and clearing. And Marion says that in Nuku'alofa, they've got a few weeks ahead of cleaning up and where they'll just be busy doing that.
It's a lot of work, especially towards the most disastrous place. With us here in Nuku'alofa, we will have to look at our drinking water. I've always been saying our drinking water because to me, it's one of my main concerns. Secondly, we will be looking at a way forward from here. How are we going to recover from here and to move forward? And also, we're not pretty sure if the volcano is still live or not. We don't know that.
When you think about the scale of the disaster and some of the things that have been destroyed, like for some families, their entire possessions and home, it's an enormous job, even in the parts of the country that aren't the worst hit.
What have other countries around the world done so far to help Tonga with this effort? And I'm particularly interested in Australia because, as we know, we have a strong relationship with Pacific countries and, you know, a lot of responsibilities in this area.
So Australia and New Zealand were the first to act to help Tonga, which feels very fitting given the close relationship there. But for a few days, it was really difficult for any of that help to arrive. And that's largely because of the ash cloud. It wasn't safe for helicopters or planes to get in because of the thick ash that was in the air. Another big complicating factor is to do with COVID. So Tonga has recorded just a single case of COVID throughout the entire pandemic. It doesn't have, you know, the best resourced and most robust health system at the best of times, never mind they've just been hit by an unprecedented natural disaster. And so they're very frightened that aid efforts could bring COVID in alarming waves to Tonga. So all aid that is being delivered in a contactless fashion. It's a very 2022 sort of humanitarian crisis, this one. Australia and New Zealand have sent ships. They've sent naval ships. They've sent aeroplanes with relief supplies, with bulk water, with hygiene kits, with tarpaulins, the sorts of things that are needed in the sort of immediate aftermath of a crisis. And they've also committed funds. So Australia's committed $1 million. New Zealand has committed $2 million to the relief efforts in Tonga.
So $1 million from Australia so far. It doesn't sound like a whole lot considering the scale of the disaster that you and Marion have just outlined. How does that compare to what other countries have committed worldwide?
Yeah, there have been commitments around the world. So Japan has committed $1 million US. China has committed 100,000. We've had 10 million from the Asian Development Bank, 8 million from the World Bank. So there are commitments that are rolling in. Australia's had a bit of criticism for just committing $1 million, but that's maybe not thought of as a huge amount. And I think Tonga, I think they would welcome more money coming in down the track. But it is also a really, it's standard practice and actually really good practice in the aid sector to provide relief and a certain amount of money up front and then to wait a little bit, to take a beat and see what the need is in the long term and then come back in with more relief efforts. So I think the hope would be that more money would come in down the track as it's seen what the need is going to be.
We don't know how long we're going to be living with this, not only physical stuff, but also mentally, because we have been affected mentally because we have never experienced this. We have experienced tropical cyclones to the worst, but this is just so new. And I know no one will never forget this ever.
So, Kate, I imagine this is just very different to if a volcano erupted off the coast of Australia, right? Tonga has very unique challenges as a small island nation and a small economy. What are we looking at here in terms of the recovery? I mean, is this a few months? Is this years? What do you think?
It's really tricky to say because, as you say, Tonga, it starts from a tricky place. Roughly 20% of Tongans live below the poverty line. It's not a rich country. Its GDP per capita is about 5,000 US per person. You know, much of the economy of Tonga is generated outside of Tonga by family members and relatives in the Tongan diaspora who send money back in remittances. So there's not a lot of wealth that is there or to sort of kick things along and kick an economy back into gear. It's really tricky. And another thing to think about is actually that this, you know, Tonga is already hit by way more than its fair share of natural disasters. The cyclone season for Tonga is long and intense, and they are frequently hit by really economy-wrecking, home-wrecking cyclones. And actually, one of the reasons Tonga's a very indebted country, and a key reason it's in so much debt to foreign countries, including China, is that they have these huge natural disasters, and then rebuilding costs so much money, so they have to borrow. So it's got a lot of challenges that it faces for rebuilding. And I think for me, watching this unfold, it's been really wonderful to see the attention that this disaster has received internationally, because sometimes as Pacific Editor, we cover the cyclones that hit the region, and it is honestly very hard to get readers to care about those stories and to click on those stories. And it hasn't been a challenge to get people to care about this disaster. But I think the fear that I have and the fear that Marion expressed is that now that we've got news from Tonga, now we know the death toll is low and likely to stay low, now we've got images coming through, that the world will look away and the world will forget Tonga, and that the sustained help and the sustained attention that Tonga and this crisis needs won't eventuate, and Tonga will be forgotten.
I may stay calm, but we need help.
That was Tongan journalist Marion Kupu and Guardian Australia's Pacific editor Kate Lyons. You can read more about Tonga at theguardian.com, and we've put a link on the full story page to Kate and Marion's piece, We Had to Mimic Everyone to Run, How Tonga's Volcano and Tsunami Disaster Unfolded, which is really worth a read. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Laura Briley-Newton, Ellen Lee Beater, and Joe Koning, who also did the sound design. Mixing by Camilla Hannon. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Martignoni, Gabrielle Jackson, and me, Laura Murphy Oates. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you tomorrow.